Chapter 21. Fasts and Tortures. The fast began, then for some time they felt a little disturbed, and came every now and then with proposals and threats. They brought some typed copies of applications written on our behalf to the Punjab government and asked us to sign them. Thus they tried to give us a false assurance that something was being done for us. But we were not so soft and ignorant as to be easily fooled by their hypocritical assurances. But it is quite possible that they forged our signatures and sent those applications to higher authorities. My fast began. We were immediately separated from each other. What happened to him after this, I do not know. The IG prisons came. Like one who was bewildered, he did not listen to anything I had to say, but kept on harping that the political privileges have been eliminated, and now there were only two classes, special and ordinary. If I wanted special class, I should put up an application, otherwise I would be treated as an ordinary prisoner. I told him that I was not prepared to put up the type of application he wanted, nor did I ask for any special class. All I asked for was that I should be given the facilities and treatment which my history ticket showed was given in the last prison. The terms recorded on my history ticket had become the rules for us. He then went away. He came again when the superintendent was treating us with savage brutality by using force. For all his malignant ends. So when he came near me and told me sternly, "This superintendent of yours has now stooped to the most tyrannous methods of using force and insulting and humiliating me," I considered my duty to tell you frankly and firmly that I am a disciple of Guru Gobind Singh and not of Mahatma Gandhi, who would stick to non-violence even under extreme humiliation. We have been taught by the Guru to give up non-violence when a person's faith and religious ideals are subjected to insult and humiliation through force and violence. For the projection of the sacred principles of our faith, when non-violence fails, we would not die like cowards. It is not violence to prevent, with all the power at your disposal. The tyrants from carrying out their evil designs or to prevent the godless and brutal people from causing injury to the faith and freedom of man. So if any white man or Indian of your department uses force against me to insult and cause injury to my religious sentiments and principles, I will fight back. Do not think that I will not be able to defend myself, because I have been fasting since many days. A hungry lion becomes very desperate when somebody annoys it, even if the lion is in a cage. On hearing this, the IG prisons gave me assurance that no force would be used against me, but the prison officials were bent upon doing the worst. Who could prevent them? After a day or two, they started the mischief. After this, many terrible things happened. In many ways, they came again and again to use force and cause all types of physical injury. Many times, the jail authorities came with a number of their warders and servants, but as soon as they tried to hold me by force, I pushed them back. No one dared come close or to grapple with me alone. The heroic fire of the Khalsa, even though starving, created a terror in the minds of all. One day the jailer, Mr. Wig, an Englishman, came with all his staff and started shouting at me and threatened to give an email by force. I told him that he had no right to do such a thing, and I would not let him do anything. I had not taken anything for many weeks and had no constipation. Where was the necessity for me to have an enema? I had not even taken a drop of water for many days. What was the purpose of giving me this? If I suffered from constipation, I could accept the advice of a doctor. An enema is given when the medicine of a doctor fails to work. Why are you forcibly giving me this? You are not a physician, I said. The jailer, we have been ordered by the superintendent to give you enema by force. I tell him, then try to use force. I am prepared to fight back, and I will not submit like a coward. The jailer says, I have many men while you are alone. What can you do? I tell him, just try to use force and see what I do. You will have a taste of it in a minute. On hearing this challenge from me, they all moved forward to overpower me When 5 or 6 men tried to pounce on me, I threw them back. Frightened and yet forced to beat me down, they came forward again. All alone, I hit them right and left. In this struggle, some got a blow in the jaws. Some were hit in the chest or stomach. Some had a bruised shoulder. Their caps and hats rolled on the ground. Some were thrown against a wall or on the pucca floor. They soon lost their breath and attempted again and again to pounce on me. The Hindu babus had to keep a hand on their dhotis, which were loosening on every struggle. The Englishmen would begin to dust their pants every time they fell on the floor. The jailer's face was red with rage, and he was trembling with fear and fury. Everyone was exhausted and hit badly. After they found that they could never overpower me, they went away. I, the one and lone Khalsa, inspired by Guru Gobind Singh, to face even the lack of the opponent, stood there unharmed. Then they brought all the jail warders and all the criminal prisoners. No Babu or officer joined the gang that was sent to overpower me. The prisoners were forced to jump on me and overpower me. "Why do you send these poor people to fight me?" I said. "Why don't you come forward? You first got your staff badly beaten and hit, and now you want these poor people to face me." All the prisoners, the prison lumbardars, lowered their heads with shame and fear. Some folded their hands from a distance, begging forgiveness for being forced to attack me. The jailer ordered them to catch hold of me and force me to lie down flat on the floor. But everyone stood silently, without moving. They neither spoke nor obeyed the orders. When he scolded them and ordered them to move forward, a Rajput warder said, "Sir, he's only a saintly patriot. He is here in the prison for the freedom of our country. He has done you no harm. What offense has he committed for which he is unnecessarily tortured? Do you not know that the course of harming such a man may bring ruin on you all? None of us dare to raise our finger against him." The jailer, roaring with rage, says, "What? Will you disobey my orders? You will be deprived of your uniform and be severely punished. You will be locked up in a dark cell." The Rajput warder, taking off his uniform and throwing it near the feet of the jailer, "Here, take your uniform and give me whatever punishment you like. You can even lock me up in a dungeon. I am not afraid of anything. To me, punishment will not be greater and more painful than the curse of this saint. I cannot tolerate this saint patriot being insulted and attacked in this manner. No other warder will help you in this matter. We are kept here for the protection of the prisoners and not to treat them in such a brutal manner." The jailer ordered that this man, whose name was Dugar Singh, should be immediately deprived of his uniform and position as the warder. He did not so frighten other warders and coerce them to use force against me. But not a single man was prepared to obey his order. He then turned his rage and threats against the prison warders and immediately took steps to punish them all. At last, feeling himself helpless in that strange situation, he went away. For the third time, the jailer came with a doctor who was ordered by the superintendent to give enema. The doctor moved a few steps towards me, but when I sharply asked him to keep away from me, he stepped back and stood at a distance. He did not wish to come into grips with me. The jailer ordered him angrily to go ahead. The doctor says, "You have not been able to hold him for a minute with the help of your whole staff and warders. How do you expect me to handle him and do it all alone? It is my duty to give him enema, but only with his consent and not against his wishes by force. My profession does not permit me to do such a thing by force." The jailer then says, "Then you should explain to him that according to the requirements of his health, you, as a doctor, advise him to take enema." The doctor, in addressing me, says, "Sardar Sahib, what is the harm in taking this?" I tell him, "I do not have any constipation. I have not taken anything for weeks. Why should I take enema?" The doctor said, "Our superintendent, who is also the chief medical officer, thinks that to maintain your health, it is essential for you to take this." I tell him, What is it that is compelling them to have done it? To have done it now and now only?" The doctor said, "The fact is that they have ordered force feeding, and it is necessary to give enema before trying force feeding. I tell him, can you say on oath that giving enema is absolutely essential before resorting to force feeding? Do the medical rules say so? Whispering in my ear, the doctor says, actually, they want to insult you and humiliate you in this way. The jailer was standing at some distance. Why don't you take enema with your own hands? He asked. I will explain to you how it is done, whispering and touching my feet humbly. For God's sakes, save me from this trouble, he said. Please accept my request. Loudly, he said, you will benefit immensely after taking enema. All the disorders caused by constipation will disappear. It will even help you in your fast. I tell him, you have made the request in such a way that I cannot refuse it. Now please explain to me how it is done. The doctor, after explaining, says, now we leave you alone. Do anything you like. The superintendent should get the impression that you have taken enema. Within 15 minutes, I got rid of everything. What happened after that has already been described in letters written earlier. I wrote the letters here. A letter, January 1923. On arrival here, our history tickets were examined, and we were given all facilities about dress and food, which we had been sanctioned in the previous jail. Bhai Kartar Singh and I are staying in the same barrack. The day we arrived, the superintendent was not here. He was on leave. He came after 5 or 6 days. As soon as he resumed duty, he started taking extreme steps to annoy us. The first order he sent to the prisoners was that all should stand up when he came to the prison barracks and keep standing with our hands spread out like beggars. We were also ordered to keep our faces raised up while saluting him. He threatened to give us severe punishment if we did not obey this order. We told him that we would never spread out our hands like beggars before anyone except God, no matter what punishment he ordered for disobeying such humiliating orders. We asked him to show us the prison rules and laws which authorized him to give such orders. When he exasperated by his futile attempts to cow us down, he started writing against us to the higher authorities. On December 30th, 1922, he called me in his office and issued orders that all facilities given to me to prepare my own food had been withdrawn, and I would be given the same barley bread prepared in the common kitchen which was given to the ordinary prisoners. I requested him to hold on his orders for a few days and permit me to write to the higher authorities. As political prisoners, we were entitled to such facilities and rights which were given to me on religious grounds. I told him that I had been getting these facilities all these years, and there was no reason why they should be withdrawn without any rhyme or reason. I requested him to permit us to appeal to the higher authorities. Until the reply to our appeal was received, we should be contented with simple food cooked by our own fans, but refused to listen to anything and immediately issued stern orders. All our prayer books, clothes, including the turbans, were forcibly taken from us. He even took away our shoes. Only our kashare was all that we had on our bodies. Our second underwear was also taken away from us. So the fast began. For about 10 days, I was allowed to live undisturbed in my cell. There was an Englishman named Big, who was especially posted to harass and torture me. He was given full powers to do whatever he liked. It is difficult to relate all the cruel ways he adopted torture on me. I endured everything silently with my mind fixed on God. He now started annoying and tormenting me every moment and threatened to inflict gruesome affliction. I remained silent. I never spoke to him nor answered any of his threats. He tried to force bread into my mouth, but I pushed him away and did not allow him to come near me. He abused and cursed me in the filthiest language possible. One day he came near me and tried to hold me by my hair, but I stepped back, and though he used violence, I did not allow him to touch my hair. He wanted to beat me, and although I was weak, I did not allow him to come near. He pushed me against the wall and started kicking me. I shouted to the spies standing near him that they should bear witness to the fact that he was trying to kill me. Call the superintendent immediately. When I shouted these words, he shrank from going to the brutal extreme at that moment. When the superintendent came, I reported the matter to him, but he did not listen to me and sidetracked the issue. Mr. Big came all the more ferociously brutal. The same evening, Mr. Big and his assistant, who was also an Englishman, came with a number of men to forcibly give me enema. I told them that I had not taken either a morsel of food nor drunk any water for many days. I was not having constipation or any other trouble. Why were they forcibly giving me enema? They actually wanted to insult and humiliate me. Five or six of them tried to overpower me and force me to lie down, but they could not control me. The British jailer then sent five or six more warders, spies. All of them caught hold of me and knocked me down. I was already exhausted after fighting so many people for so long, and now as soon as my bare head struck against the floor, I fainted. I was stripped naked and given enema. Even as I was being stripped naked, I regained a little consciousness and was about to speak, but they knocked me down again. They only wanted to mortify and humiliate me. When they went away, they threatened to insult and inflict outrageous indignities on me the next day, until the pretext of force-feeding through a rubber tube. I spent the whole night in great mental agony. The next day, they again started using force to knock me down. Even the jail superintendent was there with the whole of his staff. I asked him why he was stooping to such cruelty. The superintendent, a Hindu, threatened to inflict such indignities as may lead to the forced breaking of my religious vows. I asked him to fear God. The superintendent said that the British government was his God. I again said, has the British government allowed you to force man to abandon his religious principles? Is it not a tyranny worse than that of Aurangzeb? The superintendent replied, is committing suicide a part of his religion? I said, I have never contemplated suicide. Committing suicide is the greatest sin according to my religion. I went on fast only to maintain my religious vows. I am prepared to take milk, fruit, or any simple food like roasted grams. In other jails, my religious principles were respected by the prison authorities. You also must listen to me. I am prepared to take the simplest food within the limits of my religious vows, but you are bent on committing outrageous acts to revile and desecrate my religious principles. But let me tell you that no one can compel me to break my religious vows. I will sacrifice my life for it. I will survive on the sustenance of his divine name. I will not die. Do not torture me unnecessarily, and do not cause any indignity to any of my religious principles. All my protests fell on deaf ears. They manacled my hands, and placing a stick in my mouth, pushed a long rubber tube down my throat into the stomach. They started force-feeding me with some milk. I controlled my psychic breath, the prana shakti, and first suppressed it in the navel, and then let it ascend to the tenth seat of consciousness, the Turiya state, the highest state. But I had become very weak and could not take psychic breath to the highest consciousness under these torturous circumstances. But as the prana shakti had gone higher than the navel and my breathing had stopped, they could not pump any milk inside. Without the breath going in and coming out, not a drop of water could be forced inside my stomach. Whatever milk was pushed in came out immediately. When they were tired of doing this without any success, they knocked my head against the floor, even before taking out the rubber. I became unconscious and my mouth was closed in a tight grip. The rubber broke into two. The bottle of milk also broke into the scuffle. Some more milk was brought. An iron tube was also procured. As I was unconscious, the superintendent ordered that my teeth should be broken and the iron tube forced into my mouth. My teeth were broken. My jaws were torn apart. Two of my teeth from the side were forcibly broken. All these tortures were inflicted by Mr. Big, who sat on my chest and did all these inhumane acts with his own hands. By forcing the iron tube down my throat, they succeeded in sending some milk into my stomach. It took them more than an hour and a half to do so. As soon as they were about to leave me alone, the milk was vomited out. My starving stomach found it difficult to retain it. I was then dragged by my beard and hair and kicked with shoes and giving heavy fisted blows. When I was almost half dead, they left me there in that miserable condition. The next day, they again forced some dal soup down my throat. The third day, they brought soup of kosher meat and beef, and also some tobacco to cause the maximum injury to my religious sentiments. They told me that I should start eating the food that they ordered, otherwise all those things would be forced down my throat. They even threatened to shave off my hair and beard, and then I would be sent to a lunatic asylum. I have already written in other letters all that follows. A member of the prison supervision committee came to me and asked me all that had happened. I told him about the threat of giving me soup of kosher meat and beef and forcing tobacco down my throat. I did not give him all the details of the torture. The superintendent immediately denied the charge, and then when the jail inquiry officer went away, he begged me to save him. The jailer also fell at my feet and begged not to implicate him, because he did everything on the orders of the superintendent. It would not be out of place to mention an interesting incident here. When I was convinced that this wicked and depraved man, Dr. Jeter, who would not hesitate doing the most heinous deed, and when the efforts of my friends like Bhai Mansha Singh and Bhai Santa Singh of Nagpur failed to change the mind of this cruel man, my mind was clouded with dark despair. Bhai Mansha Singh even offered 500 rupees to every person who could help me to get out of the prison unscathed. But all his efforts failed. The whole of Nagpur was seething with discontent, of threats, of agitation. The eminent patriot, Dr. Abhayankar, did his utmost to help me. I have never seen such a brave and fearless freedom fighter as a lovable soul, Abhayankar. Patriots like him are indeed very rare. All my life, I would remain greatly indebted to Bhai Mansha Singh and the brave Mr. Abhayankar. My blessings will ever be with them. It now became absolutely impossible to get any aid either from outside or from within the four walls of the prison. The next day, I was to suffer intolerable indignities, and I had to do something to face it during the night. In the evening, I prayed to the all-knowing Satguru after my evening prayers to make available to me a sword to defend myself. I was prepared to fight unto death for my faith and was determined not to let my religious principles suffer blasphemous insults. With the sword in my hands, I would not allow anyone to come near me, and if they attacked me with weapons, I was determined to use sword in self-defense and fight unto death. I was also lost in this prayer. When it was over, I sat down brooding over the things to come. Suddenly, an unknown man came stealthily and stood close to the prison bars. I had never seen him before. With profound sympathy, he said in a whisper, "Ask for anything, and it shall be provided." I at once attempted to ask for the sword. I felt that the Guru had answered my prayer. Unhesitantly, he went back and came back in a matter of minutes with a sword. The sword was shining brilliantly in the moonlight. I felt overjoyed and inspired by the determination to die for my faith. The man put it back into the sheath and buried it into the mud floor, just outside my cell, from where it could be taken out easily. He asked me to take it out after the routine searching of my cell was over. With my worries over, I went to sleep. Some subtle pride had also overtaken me, as I felt my prayer was at once answered. Instead of spending the night in thanksgiving and prayer, I slept peacefully and woke up only in the morning. Instead of sitting in meditation and prayer and setting my mind into a spiritual courage, as a real and perfect Sikh should always do, I started preparing for the battle against the tyrants, and my mind was completely diverted towards a difficult situation ahead. I made up my mind to defend my faith with the sword and fight the oppressors as soon as they made any outrageous attack on the principles of my faith. Guru Gobind Singh Ji, on his letter to Aurangzeb, writes, "When all other means have failed, it is then lawful to resort to the sword." My mind was now in a very high spirit. All the depressing conditions through which I had passed disappeared. It was daybreak now. My cell was unlocked and searched superficially. They found nothing in my mattress and bed, which they searched. As soon as they had gone, I made up my mind to take out the sword out of the place where it was hidden. But the sword was not to be found there. I wondered who had taken away the sword. I covered the place with the earth. I was stunned and terribly shaken by the unexpected happening. I covered the whole hollowed place with earth and made it appear as a normal ground. What was ordained had happened, and it was no use brooding over it. In a matter of minutes, the prison authorities came and started force-feeding described in the letter above. Two of my teeth were broken, and I was tortured and submitted to excruciating agony and insult. At night, when all was silent and cold, the same unknown man came to me and said, "When you were asleep, I took away the sword. This must have given you a shocking surprise." I tell him, "After doing such a noble act as helping me to get the sword, why did you behave like a coward? Why did you show such timidity?" The unknown man said, "You may curse me or even kill me, but the inevitable has taken place. Good or bad, it has happened now, and it is my wife who persuaded me to do it." I tell him, "Ignorant man, is it wise to confide in such secrets to a woman?" Unknown man said, "I tried my best, but could not help telling her everything. Here is the story. Some unknown power compelled me to come to your aid, and I was proud of rendering the help you asked for, and felt happy about it. When I reached home, my wife had come to know that you were in serious trouble. She was very much upset and so terrified that she did not sleep all night. She was awake even on the night when I left the sword with you. Outside the prison, every man, woman, and child was talking about the cruelty and tortures to which you were submitted. Everyone was cursing and condemning the jail authorities. Everyone was shedding tears in helpless sympathy. My wife was seriously upset ever since you were in trouble. When I reached home that night, she asked me, 'Has anyone done anything to help that great patriot from a distant land? Has anyone expressed concern for him? When I think of the tortures he is being made to undergo, and unjust treatment he is yet to undergo, I cannot sleep. God alone knows how he will face the terrible ordeal tomorrow.' The unknown man said, 'What else will happen? They will forcibly cause injury to his religious sentiments, and he will die for his faith.' His wife replies, 'Alas, alas, they really force him to take beef soup.' The unknown man replies, 'Something else will happen before they ever attempt to do such a thing.' His wife says, Can you not do something to save him from terrible ordeal that he might have to face? Oh, please do something for him, even at the cost of your life.' The man replies, 'Even you have tried your best. Have you been able to do anything to save him?' The wife replies, 'I have done my utmost indeed, and now I do not know what to do. I went to the British jailer's wife and offered her all of my ornaments if she could help this saintly patriot from the Punjab. But she said, as he was a political prisoner, the matter was in the hands of the higher officials. Her husband is afraid of his superior officers. The matter could not be hushed up. Many people had offered large amounts of money and precious things, but the jailer was helpless. The superintendent is adamant. He refuses to listen to anyone.' The man replies, 'Excellent. So you have done much. This should be the spirit.' His wife says, 'You also should do something in whatever way is humanely possible. You must save this great and noble patriot from the calamity. For the freedom of our country, he has endured and suffered so much, leaving his wife and children far away. He is now undergoing terrible suffering in the prison, far away from his people. Even in the prison, he is fighting like a hero and has staked his very life for the sake of his faith. You must help him. Do help him at all costs. Whatever is possible must be done.' The man, in addressing me, says, 'When my wife talked in such a brave tone and deep sympathy for you, I unconsciously blurted out what I had done. I told her what I had done. What else was possible under those difficult circumstances? When my wife came to know about the sword which I had left you, she fainted. I poured some water into her mouth. She gained some consciousness and said, in a very sad voice, "You have committed a great blunder. That brave brother patriot will kill everyone, and as a reaction, not only will he be shot dead, but even we, all who sympathize with him and have helped him, will be done to death. There will be a bloodbath, and ultimately, he will also be ruthlessly killed. He may be immediately hanged or shot dead. Had he lived, he might have served humanity in many ways. When I had said that you must help, I meant that you must do your best to help him escape. Both his life and faith could be protected that way. If he lived, he could serve the country in many ways. You have done a horrible thing. I am in great agony, and the very thought that there will be so much bloodshed had given me an unbearable shock. The very thought of this tragic spectacle is killing. Please go there and get the sword before it is too late. Otherwise, I will kill myself." These words of my wife had a stunning effect on me. I quietly came to this place and took away the sword when you were asleep. Thank God I did so. It has all been for good. By now, there might have been a terrible bloodshed here, and God alone knows what might have been the consequences. So this matter ended here. I will close the story of torture and tyranny here, and will now relate some other events of Nagpur prison. After all the outrageous and humiliating acts of force feeding, the prison authorities now started compelling us to wear prison uniforms meant for criminals. The jailer was already madly abusing the use of his authority, and now he had a new cause to annoy us and put us into trouble. He was determined to misuse his powers to torture us on this issue. He incited the assistant jailer, who was a British officer, and ordered him to forcibly undress me and take away my clothes. I warned the jailer that if Mr. Biggs attacked me again and tried to use force, I would teach him a lesson. I asked the jailer repeatedly to stop Mr. Biggs from using force, the result of which would be serious. I was determined to fight him. I knew that there was not the slightest sense of justice left in the British administration of the jails, and there was no alternative left for us except to fight force with force and prevent cruelty and humiliation. So obstinate was this man that he refused to change his evil intention to the fury of Chandi. A good beating did not bring him to his senses. The next day, the assistant jailer came, and the first thing he did was to give a kick to my earthen pitcher. I picked up the pitcher and threw it at him. With a bang, it fell near his feet, and his clothes became wet with the water that splashed out of the broken pitcher. A few broken pieces of the pitcher also flew out and struck his face. But he was not hurt, and he did not receive any injury. The office of the superintendent was close by. Dragging his lame leg, he hurriedly came to the spot and asked what was the explosion about. "Have you thrown some bomb, Ranthir Singh?" I tell him, "There it is. The bomb has blown up into small pieces. Pick them up and institute another case against me for throwing the bomb." The superintendent, after seeing the broken pitcher, says, "How is that your pitcher is broken, and who has broken it?" "Ask your Gora assistant," I said. "There he is, standing like a jackal, wet in the with the water of the pitcher." Addressing the assistant jailer, the superintendent replies, "Well, what has happened?" The assistant jailer says, "You can see for yourself. He threw the earthen pitcher full of water at my chest, but I ran away and narrowly escaped." "How did your pant get wet?" he said. "He threw the pitcher full of water near my feet. The water made my pant wet, and pieces of broken pitcher struck me." The superintendent replies, "On the other hand, you say that he aimed the water pitcher at your chest, and on the other hand, you say that he threw it near your feet. In addressing me, well, Ranthir Singh, did you throw the pitcher at him? Did he say anything to annoy you?" I tell him, "Ask him what he did. He will tell you." In addressing the assistant jailer, the superintendent asks, "Did you speak to him roughly?" "Not at all," the assistant jailer says. "I did not say anything." "You must have done something," the superintendent replies, "to annoy him. Do you think he's mad? And he threw the pitcher of water at you without any rhyme or reason. I did nothing to annoy him, the assistant jailer says. My foot unconsciously touched the water pitcher. He picked it up and threw it at me. The superintendent stared at me, signifying by his looks that he had demanded an explanation from me. I requested him to ask the sentry on duty. He then stared at the sentry, demanding his version of the incident. In addressing the sentry, I asked, "An oath of the deity you worship, tell the superintendent the truth, and nothing but the truth." The sentry said, "Sir, the truth is that the jailer Sahib came straight to this place and knowingly kicked the water pitcher. Ranjit Singh threw the water pitcher at him, saying that it was of no use to him. For him, he considered it a great insult that he should touch his drinking water with his shoes, so he angrily threw the water pitcher at him." Angrily addressing the assistant jailer, the superintendent said, "That is what you deserved. Thank God he did not throw the water pitcher at your head. You knowingly did this mischief. I asked you not to cause any new trouble, yet you have disobeyed me." The superintendent immediately fined him ₹5, but did not say anything to me. This was the first instant that something was done in the spirit of justice. The superintendent had one significant quality, that is, he kept his subordinates firmly under his control. The jailer, who had been downgraded from the post of superintendent, feared him much. This sense of justice came to the mind of the superintendent at some rare moments, but the jailer succeeded in misguiding him. On seeing the assistant jailer reprimanded and punished, the jailer was boiling with rage and was looking for an opportunity to avenge it. The jailer had given undue powers to his assistant, who treated his subordinates shabbily, as a result of which he was disliked by all. The sipais and the jamindars sympathized with my lot after the attempt of this jailer to give me beef soup during the force feeding. A sentry was always posted near my cell to keep a watch on me. A new sentry was posted every 3 hours, sometimes every 6 hours. Thus they all knew me personally. One day, early in the morning, a sentry informed me that the jailer had ordered the assistant jailer to humiliate me by using force and violence under the pretext of taking away the clothes I was wearing and replacing them by the dress given to ordinary prisoners. He told me that the assistant jailer would be coming while he was on duty and he would attack me. The sentry said, "We, the Indian sentries, are all fed up of this man. If he comes and attacks, you can give him a good thrashing. We will not tell anyone. You may change any moment and report or give evidence against me." Replied I, "I swear by the holy Ganga that I will never betray you, but if possible, will help you," said the sentry. At this moment, the jailer came there and said in a threatening tone in English, "We have been very lenient with you. Take off your clothes. We have been far too gentle with you," he shouted. "So today you have come with the determination and show your gentlemanliness, haven't you? I said. The assistant jailer said, "Do take off your clothes or not? Or do you want me to forcibly strip naked and suffer humiliation?" I tell him, "No one dare humiliate or insult me as long as there is life in my body." "Have you not suffered humiliation enough?" he said. I reply, "It is those who tried to insult me who suffered humiliation." Both the superintendent and the jailer went down on their knees and begged forgiveness. "They have suffered disgrace, and now it is your turn." I was talking to the assistant jailer in English. He advanced towards me and lifted his hand to hold me by the throat. By pushing him away, I said, "Behave like a human being and learn some human decency." "Do you think I'm a beast?" the assistant jailer said. "Beasts are much better than you," I reply. "They eat oil cakes and grass and give milk." On hearing this, he flared up and tried to hold me by the beard. I gave him one blow to his jaw with my right hand, and on the wrist of which I was wearing a heavy iron bangle. Holding him by the throat with the left hand, I gave him another severe blow, and holding his right hand with my own right hand, tightened my grip on his throat. His eyes were staring out, and his stranglehold on his throat made him groan for breath. He gave me a kick below the belly, which I avoided by stepping aside. With one hand on the throat and the other between his legs, I lifted him up and threw him flat on the floor. Seating myself on him, I gave him blows right and left with my fist and knees. He lost his nerve and was breathing with difficulty. Then in a pitiable tone, he cried, "Well, Sardar Sahib, you also belong to a brave community, and I also belong to a brave nation. Let us be friends from tonight. Leave me and shake hands with me." He blurted out these words while he was getting severe blows from me. "You are a coward," I tell him. "Such dastardly coward like you never claimed to be brave. Even to attribute the word brave to a person like you is an insult to the word. I am not prepared to shake hands with you, and I consider it an insult and below my dignity to befriend you." He was in the habit of terrorizing the prisoners, and now he was helplessly crying and cringed like a jackal. What do you say, Sardar Sahib? I have not understood," he said. "What will I gain if you do understand?" "I have not understood it. Even now, you are the greatest fool," I replied. He then begged for mercy in the name of Christ and God. As soon as I started beating him, the sentry moved away into the courtyard. He did so to avoid being an eyewitness. If he was at all called a witness, he would simply say that he was outside in the courtyard. He did not know anything about the row and scuffle that took place in the prison. The white man was still lying on the floor under my tight grip when he nervously looked around and asked me, "Sardar Sahib, are you sure that the sentry did not see us? What if he has seen us? He will not rob me of anything." I said, the assistant jailer nervously said, "Oh, he can, of course, do not harm to you, but I will be ruined. It is indeed a good thing if he has not seen us. It would mean a terrible humiliation for me. For God's sake, leave me now and promise me that you will not again tell that you have trounced and spanked me so terribly. I will suffer great humiliation if you do. Please take pity on me and do at least this much for me. You are not prepared to shake hands with me, and you will not befriend me. For God's sake, pity my lot. You are a religious man and spend most of your time in prayer, so I appeal to you in the name of God to spare me the humiliation that I may have to suffer." On seeing him so frustrated and disconcerted, I let him go. He stood up, and humbly folding his hands, he again begged me to promise that I not tell anyone of what had happened. After getting a good beating, he went away. The sentry came there, and when he had gone, he was very happy that the white man had been taught a lesson. I asked the sentry why he was so afraid of him. "Whether I fear him or not, he said, "I will never give evidence in his favor, not even if I have to lose my job." I told him that the assistant jailer himself feared lest the matter is not leaked out. He had taken a promise from me that I will not tell anyone. He appealed to me in the name of God to spare him further humiliation. So I advised the sentry to keep his mouth shut and not tell anyone. He was the only person who knew about it and had seen everything. The sentry was extremely happy to know this and laughed so heartily over it that he could not control his laughter for a long time. After getting the terrible beating, the assistant jailer went straight to the superintendent and submitted his resignation, saying, I do not wish to work here anymore." The superintendent says, "Any reason for resigning?" "What other reason can there be?" the assistant jailer replies. "I am not prepared to serve on such a tough job." "You better take up only office work," the superintendent said. "What is tough in it?" "You are excessively cruel to the sick," the assistant jailer said. "You sit in command and have all cruelty perpetuated through me. All they want is their legitimate right. In all the jails, they have been treated as political prisoners, and now in this jail, I have been made the instrument of the authorities to treat him in an excessively cruel manner. You do not do anything but order me to do it. So I am going to resign. I am neither prepared to have any hand in the inhumane treatment of the sick prisoners, nor can I tolerate the very sight of it now. So please accept my resignation. In my resignation, I have given 15 days notice, after which I will leave the job without informing anyone. I am not prepared to see the prisoners under me treated so cruelly. Why don't you permit them the clothes, the turban, and the kashera, which has been sanctioned by the Punjab government by law, and their religious sentiments demand it? They will not wear the cheap underwears and coarse turbans spun and prepared in the jail. As prison officer in charge of the prisoners, I strongly recommend that they should be given all the facilities allowed to political prisoners. They are imperial prisoners because they have waged war against the King Emperor under Section 121. They should be treated exactly as we have been treating German war prisoners. Thus, the assistant jailer spoke very strongly in favor of better treatment for us. Although I did not accept his hand of friendship, but by word and deed he proved to be a real friend and was true to his promise. Although he extended his hand of friendship under duress, but he showed it by his deed that he had become a true friend. After this, we encountered very little trouble about permission to wear turbans and kashere. We were allowed to color our turbans in navy blue color. We also got the kashere stitched as we liked and never used the striped cloth made in prison for it. Bhai Kartar Singh was once more lodged near me. He recited the Sukhmani from memory, and once more I enjoyed the heavenly spiritual flights of meditation and prayer. Our friendship and spiritual relations deepened. They were indeed the golden days of spiritual exaltation. As soon as I remember the bliss and joy of those golden days of spiritual enlightenment, I feel very happy. Unfortunately, I did not have any notebook to keep record of the wonderful events of this period, nor did I get any opportunity to write any letter from the jail about the events of those days. Now I remember only some events. The memory of those days has faded a good deal. Now I have to scrape up my memory and write about a few important events. The prison letters did not contain the whole story of our life in prison. Whatever I remember now, I am recording for the benefit of friends. My friend Bhai Kartar Singh remembers a lot. His memory is very sharp. I am giving you the gist of important events. As long as this wicked superintendent was there, there were always some protests, some morchas. But he did not give us any breathing time. He was always up to some mischief or the other. The physical tortures sharpened my moral powers and exalted me spiritually. Each arrow of agony deepened my feelings and helped me in my efforts to achieve the highest spiritual realization. And once I sat absorbed in mystic meditation, no one could disturb me. Even if I was skinned alive, the fearless state acquired could not be shaken out of this mental and spiritual poise. This lame doctor, the superintendent, only completed the revenge of an old score of his last birth, as was graciously revealed to me in my vision by the Lord in Rajamundri prison. Whatever excessive tortures he inflicted will fall on his head, and he shall have to suffer for them for many births. It was in his nature to continue to think of some novel ways of doing mischief and causing injury. When all his plans and evil designs were defeated in their purpose, he took away our books and manuscripts of some books I had written. We lodged many reports against this ugly step he had taken, but it did not return our books and manuscripts. Whenever a non-official visitor came to see us, he would agree to return the books, but would not do so when they were gone. 6 years passed in this way. Ultimately, Bhai Kartar Singh threatened to take dire action when the Inspector General of Prisons came on his next visit, but he still disregarded the threat. He then told us that he had burnt all the books. We then took him to task and threatened to take legal action against him for burning our prayer books. He then took out all the books and showed us that they were safe. He did not return them to us, but ordered that they should be given to us when we were either released or transferred to some other prison.